Today's program is brought to you by Oya, a contemporary Japanese restaurant. For more information, visit oyarestaurantboston.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
Have you ever taken a job but already had a vacation planned? Well, that's sort of what happened with this week's show. We decided to do this podcast, but I, Andrew, am going to be away on the 21st of January, so this is a pre-tape show, but we're going to make it up to you because we have the great David Kinch of Manresa Restaurant in Los Gatos, California, who just opened his second restaurant, The Bywater, in the same town of Los Gatos. It's a restaurant inspired by his New Orleans youth and food memories of that town, and we're going to be speaking with David in just a moment.
So on this week's Shop Talk, we're going to talk to three New York City chefs and sous chefs about what it's like to be a sous chef in this year, 2016.
Okay, but first, let's get right to David Kinch. Good morning, David.
Morning. How are you guys?
We're great. Thank you for calling in all the way from California.
Hi,
not
David.
Not a problem.
How you doing, David? It's Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. How are you? Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I wanted to start off with talking about your opening. How was your opening last night? Was it 2 days ago?
Yes, we opened up on Tuesday for lunch. We're doing lunches and dinners. We opened up, and it's been a dull roar. It's been good.
Was it pretty strong right out of the blocks? I mean, I assume in that area, this is obviously your name on anything, and then being far from the city, I would think this would be a pretty big event for the town.
Well, for Los Gatos, yeah, it's been really nice. It's a casual place, and it's not far from where we are. But we had a line out the door first day. There's a lot of people curious and wanted to check us out. It's got a nice little. It sits the building itself sits on a pretty prominently on a nice little stretch of street. So I think a good part of the town has walked by and seen our progress over the past 6 months as we've done the build out.
I'm curious to ask you, David, and the whole genesis of this restaurant, the idea of New Orleans, the fact that you grew up in New Orleans, first became interested in food at that time in your life, there seems to be this real element of nostalgia, I guess is the word I would use. Feel free to correct me, but in sort of where you are these days, I think about your Manresa book and the fact that there was a chapter in there dedicated to dishes inspired by Barry Wine, who you worked for, quite a while ago in New York City. And now this restaurant, which is inspired by a time in your life that actually predated that. I'm just curious, where does nostalgia factor in for you? Is it a very sort of conscious part of how you are developing projects and who you are these days? Or is it just something that flows naturally that you don't even have to think of? How much have you thought about this topic?
That's a big question there. I mean, nostalgia, was it a conscious decision? I mean, I didn't sit down and try to think, okay, thematically, what am I going to do with this next project? Manresa has been open for at least 14 years in July. A lot of people have wondered why, it's taken this long to actually do a second project. Maybe I just finally figured out how to do it.
Right.
And to do it right, to do it to where it grows organically, it grows naturally, and it's not a forced, quote unquote business decision to do it. It's something that we really wanted to do, and we had the resources to do it. For me, in thinking about what I wanted to do, I thought about many things, but I found myself coming back always to New Orleans, and I think a lot of it has to do with it being such a fun place. People always have great reactions when they go there, whether it's the food, the music, the ambiance, the good times that one can have there.
Right.
And for me, it was a very happy time in my life. It was very important because it's where I fell in love with the restaurant business and then consequently fell in love with cooking. So it meant a lot to me. Selfishly, I created a place that, I wanted to go to on my day off or after I finished work. in terms of what I wanted to eat, perhaps what I wanted to drink, and of course what I wanted to listen to. The Bywater has no pretension whatsoever, and that is by design. You know, if we start to develop any sort of pretense, I'm going to shut it down. It's a neighborhood joint, is what I'm calling it.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to be. In terms of nostalgia for a cook, chefs are, we build upon our experiences, whether it's travel or what we grew up with. At least I think the good ones do. You build upon what you've experienced and what you have learned in the past, and you use those, the building blocks, as you create your own style, as you become more a more mature chef.
Right.
And so, if you sit down there and try to imitate someone or imitate something that you find really cool or affects you in a certain way, that's great. But I think if you can grow from your own personal experiences as a young cook, then I think it makes it have more gravitas.
Just a quick follow up on that. Obviously we lost Paul Prudhomme when you were in the process of developing this restaurant. Just wondering, did that add an extra layer of sort of import to the project for you, or an extra happiness to you that you were doing something that sort of pays tribute to New Orleans? I mean, New Orleans, a lot of younger cooks might not realize this, but Paul Prudhomme and that town, in terms of the evolution of an American culinary identity, it's a super important place, and largely because of Prudhomme, but not exclusively because of him. But I'm just wondering if the loss of that chef at around the time you were, getting this place together, added anything to the project for you, just emotionally?
Not really. Because of his passing, some of the obits were really great. The New York Times in particular, I think, younger cooks, another generation of cooks say, it's a shame they don't even really, they may have heard his name, but don't really know who he was. I mean, he was on that first tier level of, and I hate to use the word, of celebrity chef. Let's call it a chef that had, much more of a prominence outside of just his industry. And I mean that in a good way. I don't mean that in terms of celebrity chef or TV chef. I mean, in terms of advances that were made in the industry that allowed cooks to do what they do now. The power they have now in the media and the ability to do what they do now is because of people like Chef Paul. I mean, Paul, he developed a regional cuisine. He made that regional cuisine famous outside of his region. He did the first pop-ups. Remember, he would pack right. his restaurant up and go to San Francisco and New York for 6 weeks at a time,
yep.
3 months at a time. I think I just arrived in New York myself, when he was doing his New York thing, and I can't, it was down on West, Broadway or Lafayette or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was Lower Broadway.
Yeah, I mean, there was a line out the door for 3 months, to go to his place to check it out. And I don't think a lot of people realize, how badass he was back then. So, of course, it's really sad to hear of his passing. Hats off to folks like him. It allowed people like us to, talk on a radio station.
Right.
And people get to know who a chef is as opposed to just the guy in the back.
Right. He's a very special man. I remember I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and he would do 1 or 2 week stages, or not stages. He would bring his food and some of his crew up to American Place, and Larry Forgione would have them for mm-hmm. a week or mm-hmm. so. And I was fortunate enough to be able to get in the kitchen and work with him and see what he was doing. And it was really a super experience for a young cook like myself at the time. Did you want to touch on that, or I wanted to segue into talking about, I guess you celebrated your anniversary of reopening after the fire. And I guess I was curious was the absence of the restaurant as a fully functional day-to-day operation, and was that a factor in your your decision to do more concepts?
It was an impetus for many things. I mean, I'm really, the impact that the fire had on Manresa and on myself is receding really, really rapidly. And it, frankly, it couldn't happen fast enough. It's, many things burn besides building. The good news was during that period of time, it gave us a chance to take a step back and review everything that we did and everything that we do. It gave us a new perspective, and that's what we did as a team. I mean, all our employees came back, which is great, because, a restaurant is not just a building. It's the people that work in it. And what we did during this downtime, we had a chance to reevaluate every little step we did, whether it's the greeting, our bread service, a way we cook a piece of fish, or the uniforms, a color on a wall. We sat down, chefs and people in the industry, are by nature creative people, and we have ideas coming all the time. And, due to the relentlessness of our workday, a lot of times it's difficult to have the opportunity to think things through, maybe have a chance to put them in place. We would have been foolish not to view the so-called downtime, when the restaurant wasn't open and we were rebuilding, not to take advantage of that. And I think we did a pretty good job with that.
So, David, in terms of that time, it's funny. I was thinking back to an interview you and I did on Tokeland a couple of years back. And we had talked about, I'd asked this question, do other things come your way? And you were like, all the time. And you talked about being sort of drawn to what you called the bespoke nature of fine dining, which I thought was a great phrase. I'd never heard it put quite that way. But in terms of, moving into having several operations, you also have Manresa Bread, which we haven't touched on yet. You're going to have a second Manresa Bread before too long. What was it that sort of... clicked in you, and how has this changed the way you sort of think of yourself as in terms of your day to day?
It's interesting. I don't know whether the fire was kind of like a kick in the teeth, to get started, and do other things. Maybe it's I'm getting older, and I got to figure out what I'm going to do when I'm too old to be cooking in a kitchen. There's a lot of different things to think about. The thing about the expansion, personally, I think, why didn't I expand in the past? Some people might chalk it up to like a fear of failure. I don't believe that. I if you work in the restaurant business, fear of failure, doesn't come into play. By any means, I think it was more of a fear of success than anything else. And for me, it was having great people in place. Avery, who bakes our bread. All I did was work to create an opportunity for her to work on her passion. And it's the same thing with the Bywater. I have people with me that I need to keep challenged and compensated. After they work with me for a period of time, I would be foolish not to let them go off and become the competition. So I think that's been the kick in the pants to make this happen.
But it's also interesting to me, and I'm truly not, trying to kiss your ass when I say this, but, I look back, I remember years ago when I did, when I did Alfred Portale's first cookbook, and the Gotham Bar and Grill had been open like 14 years at that point. And people had been, I remember very vividly that people had been, because I knew him, and that people had been after him to do a book for years. And he wanted to wait. He didn't see a reason to hurry. He didn't see a reason to do it before he knew exactly what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. And,
of course.
I was looking over your... your bio and sort of the milestone years, and you waited a long time to do your book. I just love to hear your thought on this. It does seem to me that there's a real sort of sprint for a lot of people in their careers these days to get their own chef shingle out, to get their book, to get their television, whatever it is. People seem to be in kind of a mad dash. And it seems to me that there's a lot, your career sort of recommends taking your time a little bit.
Well, you know, maybe it's because I'm from another generation as well. I agree with you that, you know, okay, you know, you open up your restaurant, it's a success after 18 months, media success, you know. The correct path, you know, the taught path, whether it's by handlers or PR or whatever you want to accomplish, you want to be famous, you know, a cookbook is there. But I think we can all agree, you and I can agree, you know, that the best cookbooks, the cookbooks that make the most impact and have some sort of longevity are not just books with collections of recipes. Any, you know, you can put, anybody can put 75 to 90 recipes together, you know, and put in a cookbook, but the ones that are impactful are the ones that also tell a story, whatever that story may be. It may be about chef or a region or a restaurant or however it wants to be. And it takes time to have that story develop and come together. And that's how I felt. The easiest thing in the world for me to do would have been put, you know, 70 recipes together. The book would come out and then it would go away, kind of thing. I wanted to, you know, put a book together that told our story, you know, where we were at that certain place in time. I look at that book, you know, the book's 2 years old right now, and right now I find it really hard to see Manresa in that book. You know, we've moved on from that food that we were doing there. There's a couple signature things, but that book was a snapshot in time, and we're moving forward. We're dynamic. We've had a lot of things happen since then. When, you know, the restaurant burned down since then. You know, you know, the book happened because it was the right time to do a book. You know, we had had a period of time in our relationship with Cynthia at Love Apple Farms, which is a big part of our story. And I think it was the relationship with the farm that was the real impetus in having the book done. All of a sudden, we had a story to tell.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the way you talk about it. I've always loved the subtitle of that book, you know, An Edible Reflection. I think it really speaks to, you know, everything you just said, that both in terms of moving into the book and also moving on from the book, in terms of a mindset.
I wanted to segue off the book and talk a little bit about the operation for a moment. So with the opening of the Bywater and with the second Manresa bread on the way, how are you dividing your time, and what challenges or satisfactions are you deriving from that?
Well, I get a lot of satisfaction out of it. You know, it's a different, you know, the easiest part of my day is cooking. The hardest part of my day is being a good manager, learning about the business, and motivating people, managing people.
Amen to that.
The human resource thing. You know, I wish I could just cook all day, and that's simply not what's happening right now. But believe it or not, that is what I'm working towards. You know, I do have the bakery, I do have the Bywater. You know, I have, you know, there's another project or two that we have in us right now. But the good news is, I have certain people in place right now. I am putting together, you know, a management team, a management company where everything is going to be under one umbrella, and I have really good people working for us and coming to work for me. And what this is going to allow me to do is to allow these businesses to grow organically, naturally. I will have my feedback in there, but ultimately what it's going to allow me to do is to stay in my little corner in the kitchen at Manresa and be creative and cook, because that's when I'm really happy. And I hope that perhaps by the end of 2016, that's what I'm going to be back doing. Right now it's an investment in time and nature. The good news is, you know, I'm in the kitchen. If I'm in town, I'm at Manresa every night, whether, you know, the bakery's going full speed or whether Bywater's going on. Past 2 days, I've been going back and forth. I went back and forth between Manresa and Bywater 4 times last night. I can't wait until it warms up a little bit so I can get my cruiser bike so I can, you know, ride the less than half a mile the two restaurants are from each other. But right now, it's been really good. If I took anything from Paul Prudhomme, it's the no reservation policy at the Bywater. It's great. It's been lines out the door. We've been very fortunate from since yesterday.
That's great. David, just last question. When I hear you talk about, you know, getting to Manresa and the kind of the end game for you to be in there as much as you can, it seems to me to almost run against the grain of the path that a lot of guys take when they kind of reach the stage in their career where you are. It sounds like you plan to be in your kitchen for quite a while. That's still really where you see yourself and where you're the happiest.
Well, it's certainly where I'm the happiest. And, you know, the restaurant, I keep hating to go back to it, but, you know, and, you know, we came this close, holding thumb and forefinger an inch apart from losing everything.
Yeah.
With the fire, you know, we were very fortunate, you know, it burned a little bit longer. There would have been nothing. And I don't know if we could have, you know, come back. Maybe we could have started over, but it wasn't good. It would have been starting over. And it puts, you know, it kind of shocks you, you know, having everything taken away. So there's newfound value on how we approach everything and everything that we do. And when I reevaluate, you know, I think, how am I going to be happy? What's my end game? You know, I'm going to be 55 years old this year. And what's the end game going to be? And for me, it's important that I find happiness with myself and happiness with my with what I do. You know, this is, you and I know that this is a really shitty industry to be in. If you don't like it, it will wear you out and throw you out really quickly, both physically and mentally and emotionally. You have to love it, and I want to stay in love with it. So in reevaluating that, you know, for me, it's being in a kitchen and cooking. It's not being a businessman. And so I want to set things up. I'm investing my time in everything. And, you know, as I slowly fade away, I want to fade away, you know, working and cooking in my kitchen.
Great. Well, David, it's been so great to have you on. We really appreciate you calling in on this busy week, 2 days after opening the Bywater.
Of course.
Our guest has been David Kinch of Manresa Restaurant, the Bywater, and Manresa Bread, calling in from Los Gatos, California. And the Front Burner is going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the state of the sous chef 2016. See you in a minute.
Today's program is brought to you by Oya, a contemporary Japanese restaurant. Chef Tim and Nancy Cushman opened Oya, a contemporary Japanese restaurant, in March 2007. Since opening, the restaurant has received numerous accolades, including Tim being named Best Chef Northeast by the James Beard Foundation in 2012. Oya was named by the New York Times food critic Frank Bruni as the number one new restaurant in the United States in 2008. Oya is a contemporary Japanese restaurant located in an almost 100-year-old fire station in the historic Leather District of Boston. The menu is izakaya style, which consists of a variety of small plates and is designed to encourage exploring a variety of flavors throughout the meal. The extensive menu includes creative nigiri-style sushi and sashimi, as well as a variety of cooked dishes like luxurious wagyu beef, kurubuta pork, and poulet rouge chicken. A chef's tasting menu, or omakase, is offered and consists of 17-plus courses. A grand tasting menu is also offered, consisting of 20-plus courses, most of which are designed exclusively for that menu. An extensive list of premium sakes, shochus, and Japanese whiskeys are served. For more information, visit oyarestaurantboston.com.
And welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. In this week's Shop Talk segment, we're going to look at what it's like to be a sous chef in the year 2016. In the studio with us, we have Ashley Rath, who's currently a sous chef at Santina, Jamie Young, who was most recently chef de cuisine at Atera, and Michael Gibney, who's been a sous chef and a chef and and last year published his first book, Sous Chef, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It's the second person account of a day in the life of a New York City sous chef, and it's just brilliant. All three are based in New York City. All three are in the studio with us. So what we thought we'd start with, because there's so many titles kind of bandied around these days, you know, Jamie, when I got in touch with you for the show, I was given your name by a mutual friend of ours, and, you know, I'd very specifically said we were looking for some sous chefs to come in. You know, when I called you, you said to me, well, I was, you know, most recently chef de cuisine. And it was funny to us because Jimmy and I had recently had this talk and we were trying to figure out, you know, when, you know, back in the day, like if you went back to the 90s and talked to all these people who were chefs at that time, It was sort of, you know, there were chefs, and most of them, a lot of them had one restaurant, and they were there, and they had sous chefs who were, and a lot of times, the equivalent of what today you would call, you know, a chef de cuisine. So I'm just curious, how, we'll start with you, and then maybe we can move around the group, but, you know, how do you define what is a sous chef today?
I mean, a sous chef is a manager. You know, they take care of day-to-day operations, ordering, staff management, you know, standard and quality of the mise en place, you know, that, you know, is required every day.
Right.
I think a key difference for me and our experience at Atera was that I worked really close with Matt. So I did less of the ordering and kind of less of the managing, but more of the R&D and more of the development of anything that was kind of happening in the future.
Right.
You know, and then the management of the sous chefs.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people these days, and again, there didn't used to be this distinction, but, you know, they think of a chef de cuisine as somebody who probably is responsible for a certain portion of the menu, of the concepting of dishes, of sometimes, you know, the majority share of that task, ultimately, at some point. You know, I think in some ways, and as we were getting ready to do this show, some people had said to me, well, you know, there started to be these new titles when chefs started to have more and more restaurants, and there needed to be somebody sort of minding the store, and this perception of, you know, there is a chef here, you know, every day.
Right.
But how would you distinguish between like a chef de cuisine and a sous chef?
Well, I guess I was really responsible for kind of, I guess, working closely with Matt, you know. He had so many ideas all the time. So we were always constantly kind of working on new techniques and new ideas. So I was, even with the sous chefs, I guess I was leading the team as far as how we develop new ideas and concepts with
right.
Matt, or his ideas rather.
Yeah.
And then we would technically figure out how we would execute that at the standard that we were trying to set.
Yeah.
So I guess the difference comes in inspiration and leadership and management.
Yeah.
How we motivate our cooks every day to come in and achieve a new standard or become better than they were. And I think also a key thing that we were trying to develop as an upper management team was a kind of culture we were creating in the kitchen where cooks felt inspired every day to come in and learn and push themselves. So, you know, as far as that's concerned, I think that was a major difference to kind of set that standard and that tone where we would create this new environment for cooks to kind of develop and, you know,
right.
flourish.
Thank you. Ashley, can we hear from you on this? I'm just curious. You worked at Gramercy Tavern. You worked at Atera. You're working at Santina now. How many years were you cooking before you had the designation sous chef? And if you could maybe speak just generally, how long do you think people plan to sort of be at that? You know, to me, that's really that's the pivot role, right? That's where you're sort of thinking about transitioning from being a cook to the day when you're probably going to become a chef. What's sort of, for your generation of cooks, what do you think is sort of the median time one expects to sort of be in that place in your career?
I was cooking for about 4.5 years before I took my first sous chef position, which was a year ago. And I actually think it was too soon. I think you should be cooking for at least 5, 6, 7 years. You should feel comfortable enough with your trade that you can actually manage and teach people. But I had the opportunity to work for a chef that I wanted to, my chef, Dan Haar. So I jumped at it. I think people, though, take sous chef positions very early these days.
You do.
And yes.
Is there, like you said, maybe 5 or 6 years of cooking before you're a sous chef? Is there an amount of time in your mind or in the collect, you know, each of you in your minds of how much time you would spend as a sous chef or is proper to be a sous chef or a thought on that line?
I personally feel like part of the reason that I wrote the book from the perspective of a sous chef is that it's one of the positions that you stay in probably for the longest amount of time in your career. And I think you learn probably the most. You can learn cooking and techniques in school, and you learn how to be a good cook in a restaurant and at varying degrees of a restaurant, but it takes a really long time to learn how to be a chef. And I think that's what you're doing when you are a sous chef. You're you know, it's as Chef Kinch was saying earlier, you're developing that human resource component, learning how to order, learning how to run the space, but also learning how to manage people. And I think that, you know, a lot of kids these days are jumping into chef positions, I think, too early because they don't have that component, that understanding how to not just manage people or how to, you know, get them to do what it is that you want them to do for your restaurant or be up to your standard, but also how to inspire them and guide them as young cooks. You know, I feel like it's an interesting thing to think about how you must instruct somebody so that they can become the next future chef. Just as you are a sous chef waiting to move into the chef field, a young cook was you once waiting to move into a sous chef position. So you need to teach them, rather than just get frustrated, you need to teach them how to do things better, how to be more motivated, how to be active in the kitchen, how to just become the next sous chef. You know, today's cooks are tomorrow's sous chefs. Today's sous chefs are tomorrow's chefs.
Right. A lot of give back.
I think that's like the biggest part. It's been hard learning how to do ordering and food costs and labor costs and payroll, but you can learn that. But learning how to manage somebody is incredibly difficult, and I'm still learning. And you have to, you can't just get mad, as you were saying, or you can't get aggressive. You actually have to teach people. And one of the key people in my life that showed me that was actually Jamie here. At Atera, he wouldn't get mad at you at first if you didn't know how to do something. He would show you how to do it. And if he took that time, even if he was that busy, and you did it wrong again, then he would get mad. And that's what I'm trying to, like, it's so easy to be like, why are you doing this wrong? I know how to do this, but you're a sous chef for a specific reason. You need to teach people.
Well, I feel like chefs very rarely verbalize that to people, you know, vocalize, like, listen, you know, as a sous chef, you know, it's interesting, you know, as a sous chef, you're training people, or as a chef, you're training cooks. But as a sous chef, the training from above, it's you don't always have those conversations of, you know, this is how you got to learn how to guide people, or this is, you know, you as a young sous chef, this is the next step you should be shooting for, rather than just trying to get your own restaurant or trying to get, you know, the cook that you got a bone to pick with to peel the vegetables better or whatever. There are different stages throughout your career as a sous chef that you need to aspire to. And I think that's, you know, an important thing for chefs probably to bear in mind is how to cultivate a great sous chef, which is an interesting thought, I think.
That's a great way to put it. It's a proving ground to really grow and build your own foundation. So there is no real natural amount of time it takes, but it comes down to the house that you're in and where you want to go with your career.
I mean, I think that also, I think the trickiest part for me coming up as a sous chef and further was learning how to, I guess, get the most out of people. So you almost become like, I hate to say it, but like a therapist in a way. You have to treat each individual differently because they are different people. So the best way to cultivate a young cook is to kind of look at them and see who they are as a person and then learn how to approach them in a way that they will understand. So you can't get mad at someone because they can't, you know, maybe they don't know how to do something a specific way, and maybe the way you're saying it to them isn't quite right. You know, maybe you need to change your perspective on how you show people, how you talk to each individual. And I felt personally that I got the most out of that. I mean, coming up there, like Mike said, it's tough. Some people don't. Like, where do you learn how to manage people? Who shows you that? Chef is busy all the time. He's got concepts and ideas he's working on. He doesn't have time for that, you know? So you need to learn yourself almost how to manage people a lot of the time. You're on your own a lot of it.
It's a really striking thing to me, and it's been the case. It's something I've observed since I started to be around people who do what you all do for a living, you know, 20 years ago. But, you know, this management piece is really interesting. It's this thing that, you know, it doesn't seem to really be taught in schools. There's almost this... you know, there is this whole culture, which I think is really useful in a way, of the sort of sink or swim thing, and you get thrown into situations and kitchens, and you're expected to sort of show up like a mercenary and be able, you know, that's what a trail is, right? You come in and you trail, and can you keep up? And if you can keep up with the pack, you know, maybe you'll get invited to be part of the pack, and if not, you might kind of get left, you know, behind and told, sorry, it didn't work out. But, you know, there is this thing that in most other professions, you know, orientations, that happen, you know, a buddy system in a new job. These things do not exist still, really, in professional kitchens. Is that accurate?
I think so. But also, you know, I guess, I don't know, I guess you really can't prepare for that, even if you go to school for management. I mean, when you meet your first, like, difficult individual to deal with that works for you, I mean, no one, tells you how to deal with them, you know? So it's up to you to figure out how to, you know, how to approach them in a way that you get the most productivity out of them and show them what is capable for themselves. You know, I always thought that if you could show a cook what their potential is, no matter what their insecurity is or what their inability at the moment was, that as long as they saw they had the opportunity to grow as a cook, all you had to do was kind of point them in the right direction. And that depends on how you approach them.
Right. You're a natural born leader. That's really well said.
What about how people are developing these days? You know, we're talking about this position as sort of the transitional role between being a cook and being a chef. You know, something that I've observed, and anyone here who could speak to it, who has maybe done it or has friends doing it, you know, it seems to me, you know, this notion of pop-ups, you know, we were just talking to David Kinch, who said, you know, Paul Prudhomme did these pop-ups back, and they were among the very first thing. They weren't even called pop-ups. It was just Paul Prudhomme's, like, roadshow. But I feel like I've observed a lot of people sort of at the sous chef level doing, you know, pop-up dinners or private dining events or these sort of one-offs as a way to sort of put into practice and to almost sort of, you know, what in theater they would call workshop, right? Their own ideas, you know, things that used to have no outlet sort of beyond someone's notebook or maybe, you know, a dinner party for their, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend or you know, two or three other people in their apartment. Now, by virtue of there being, you know, these ticket services that are out there and, you know, venues that are almost like black boxes that can be had. Can somebody, anybody speak to this notion? How much are you seeing this around and how much of a factor is it these days?
Well, I think it's a huge factor, and I think it's a reflection of the changing landscape of the world, you know, connectivity that people have. And I think that it has to do, particularly in New York. New York is a tough town, and the expectations are really high, and people expect a quick turnover. So I feel like less are people willing to invest, you know, $500,000-$750,000 into a restaurant without knowing that, you know, without giving it a little bit of a proving ground, without knowing whether or not people have any interest in coming there to begin with. And I think it's a lot easier if you have a buddy who's got a restaurant and they're on hiatus or something, or if there's a small space, you know, like the black box thing, or I think we may note there's, you know, recently been just these kind of spaces that are available where if you're going to do a tasting for 11 people, which is now totally acceptable and celebrated, you can use this, you can make use of this small space. Then maybe for a month or two, the rent, you can afford the rent because your investor is now paying 15 or 20 grand, before ticket sales or whatever, rather than paying, you know, $1 million or more. So I think that is sort of how I see how it fits in today. And also I think, you know, sous chefs, people, younger people of a younger generation are looking to define what our voice is. You know, I think when Prudhomme did it, it was more just, you know, it was kind of a whimsical thing. Whereas now I think people are trying to discover what the new identity of dining is and how we're going to manage it, you know, because tomorrow it's going to be on our shoulders. And it already is today, really, you know.
I think it's important to just, like, keep your name out there and stay connected as well, and that's what a lot of people use these pop-ups or private dinners for. I do some private dinners myself, and I mostly just do them because I think they're fun. I don't make that much money off of them, and it's kind of hard because I do them out of a non-kitchen, like kind of a closet, and I just find the functionality of doing it just a nice change of pace from being in a kitchen. I do get to play around with my own dishes, but I don't ever do anything that groundbreaking. Because I don't feel comfortable enough with that yet. I'm still in the very beginning sous chef stage. I like working for another chef. I like getting to understand their palate and learning from that. And so I plan on being a sous chef for quite some time.
Yeah, I'm curious, though, when you say that, Ashley, when you do these dinners, though, you do get this experience that used to not be available to people, mm-hmm. which is you're cooking your food, maybe some new ideas you're trying out. You're serving it to a larger group than one or two friends, you know, sitting at your counter or your table in your apartment. and you're seeing how they react. You're seeing what their faces are like when they're eating it. You're hearing the noises that are going on around a table. Is that useful for you as a developing chef, cook, whatever you want to call where you are in this point in your life?
Yeah, I definitely think it's useful. It's also completely satisfying when you get to see people eating your food and enjoying it. Right now, I think the most that I get out from doing them is just learning how to be more functional in different spaces. So I have fun with them. But yeah.
Can you just expand on that a little when you say more functional in different spaces?
I'm learning how to, let's say I only have a butane burner and a circulator, but I want to do lamb loin and risotto. How do I make this happen?
Right.
I find I used to do events with my old chef, Mike Anthony, and I actually have the most fun with them because I like being challenged and having to cook in a non-formal way.
It's maybe a little bit more like a caterer or out-of-house person would approach it versus someone who's at their own business each day.
Yeah, and I want to be in a kitchen for the rest of my life. I hope my love of it allows me to be in it for the rest of my life, but I like doing these side things because it just keeps me on my toes.
But it's a good point because there's so many different kinds of kitchens. You know, you could be the chef or a cook or a sous chef, and let's say the restaurant has 300, 400, 500 seats. That's going to be a very different experience or a very different job or very different requirements than if you had 30 or 40 or 50 seats, you know.
Well, and it was also, wasn't it Funk 2 that lost the power to their kitchen?
It was,
and they had to be
for weeks.
They had to figure out how to do it. And I think I would be comfortable being able to figure out a problem like that. And that's the biggest thing for a sous chef too. You have to problem solve. You are like thrown so many curveballs every single day. Baldor didn't come. Cooks called out. Somebody forgot the key to the restaurant, and I had to figure out how to break in.
Putting out fires.
Yeah, it's you know, we talk a lot about the food, and that's, you know, really what we do for a living. We make food, but that's maybe one half or one third of everything we do. You know, Chef Kinch touched on, you know, his best moment is standing in his kitchen and participating with the food. But we don't always get to do that, right? There's a business aspect of it. We touched on the human resources and the people, but there's also a money aspect that goes to it. You know, writing a schedule and buying food. You know, a chef has the ability to pick up the phone and spend $1 million, $500,000, $2 million a year buying food. And That's a huge responsibility, and so I was curious how you know, any one of you can chime in, what is there a natural split between the food and the business, you know, between the chef and the sous chef, or between the sous chefs and leave the chef out of it? Or
I mean, it's a group effort. I think, you know, you have to kind of estimate what, you know, what your chef is going to need, you know, what product is available. You know, when will it be available? You know, like how often can you get a specific product that the chef likes to work with?
Right.
So it's almost like anticipation. You know, you really need to anticipate, and then also remembering like waste is a problem. Trying not to waste. You know.
Right. Is there like a clear delineation? Do you sit down with your chef and say, "I would like to be the one that does all the purchasing," or he says to you, "I would like you to do something like this," or they say to you, "I'm sorry, I don't mean to say he."
No, I think that naturally falls into place. You know, you rely on specific people to do specific things. At Atera, we had two sous chefs and myself and Matt. You know, he didn't do the ordering, but, you know, we would divide the ordering up between all of us so that we could still have the opportunity to maintain standard in the kitchen, you know, while not being taken away on phone calls all day long, you know, or text messaging purveyors nonstop. Because if your head's down at the phone, you're not really looking at what's going on, you know? So you need to pay attention to everything. So dividing it up between the sous chefs is an ideal situation because it gives everyone more time to focus on the actual restaurant and the guests that are coming in, because at the end of the day, it's like they don't really care, you know, how long you're on the phone ordering food for. It's really what happens when they sit down. So you need to make that happen every day, you know? So dividing the work is key and being organized.
Sure. And how about in your head? Like you said, if you sit down and order food, dividing the work in your head or dividing a thought in your head, what's the delineation between quality product and food cost?
I think that's up to the restaurant, you know, and I guess the philosophy, right?
Sure.
Certain chefs just want the best product you can find, and they're willing to spend the money for it. And if that's the case, and I get the green light to do that, I do that. You know, that's my job, is to find the chef the best product I can possibly find, or and the sous chefs, you know. But if we say, well, this is a great quality piece of beef, this is the best quality piece of beef. We taste it. It's, there's not too much of a difference, and we can save a little bit of money on it. You know, maybe we pull the trigger and we buy the one that's a little bit less expensive, and you know, maybe that's a good idea. But maybe there's times that it doesn't. You know, maybe he's like, no, let's get the best one, and that's fine.
Okay. Well, as always, time flies when you're on the air. We'd like to thank again our guests, David Kinch, Michael Gibney. Please give Michael's book Sous Chef a look. It's really just a terrific debut effort, and just one of my favorite things ever written about the kitchen. Ashley Rath and Jamie Young. Just a few housekeeping notes. Do you own a knife company or a chefware business, a cooking school? Here's a thought. Sponsor this show. We are a new show. We don't have a sponsor yet, but we'd love to have one. You can reach us at hosts@frontburnerpodcast.org. We'd like to thank our engineer, Liz Smith, and thanks also to Storefront Music for our theme song, Heavy Metal Gumbo. If you have any feedback or you're a chef with an idea for a segment, please write us. Again, our email is hosts@frontburnerpodcast.org. You can visit me, Andrew, at Toqueland.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter at ToquelandAndrew, T-O-Q-U-E-L-A-N-D, Andrew. And you can visit Jimmy and enjoy his food and hospitality at the Red Cat Restaurant in New York City. Follow him on Twitter at RedCatNYC or on Instagram at Chef Jimmy Bradley. For this week, I'm Andrew Friedman.
And I'm Jimmy Bradley.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back live on the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.